The mitzvah of tzedakah, the Rambam dedicates an entire section in the Arach HaZaka called Hilchos Matnas Aniyim, and he's got 10 chapters. The 10th chapter is what I want to use as my springboard for an introduction to tonight's shiur. And that is, the Rambam goes through many, many points, which I'll summarize and highlight one by one, as to what the nature of this chiyuv is. First of all, he tells us that we have to be very careful about the mitzvah of tzedakah, and we have to be more careful about this mitzvah than any other mitzvah saseh. We will not find that anywhere in the 14 books of the Rambam except for Perek Yud Hilchos Matnas Aniyim. And he goes on to say that this mitzvah represents a simon. It represents the essence or the representation of what it means to be the chosen people, the Zer Avraham. That's point number two. Point number three, he says that just like there's a throne of God up in the heavens, there's also the throne of Israel. The throne of God represents sort of his galus, his revelation, and the throne of Yisrael represents the religion of Israel. And what is the kisei of Yisrael? The kisei of Yisrael, he says, is the mitzvah of tzedakah. Tzedakah is so essential that it defines the very nature of the kisei of Yisrael. Point number three, the Rambam says there's no geula. There won't be any redemption unless through the mitzvah of tzedakah. And he quotes a pasuk in Yeshayahu Anavi, Tzion b'mishpat tipadeh v'shaveh b'tzedakah. So tzedakah is the key to bring about the redemption. Point number four, says the Rambam, a person will never get poor from giving tzedakah. On the contrary, he says, that if he has compassion and he gives tzedakah, Hashem will have compassion on him, and he will become rich. He'll get more money than what he spent on the tzedakah. Point number five, what should be my attitude towards tzedakah? He says, my attitude towards tzedakah should be that when I'm giving money to a poor person, it's like I'm giving money to my own brother, because all of Klal Yisrael are brothers. The Rambam then goes on to say that the Aniyim are looking for us, their eyes are turned towards us, they depend upon us, and we cannot turn them down. He goes on to speak about the harsh punishment and serious violation of someone who turns his back on the Aniyim and he refuses to give tzedakah when he has the wherewithal to do so. The Rambam says that the key of keys to giving tzedakah is b'sever panim yafos, with a very happy smile. The ani who's receiving your tzedakah should not feel like for you it's a burden. He should feel that you're happy for him, that you're able to participate and give him this money. And in a case where he asks you for your money and you don't have any money to give him, then at least, at the very minimum, you have to be mafayis him bidvarim. You have to sort of calm him down, give him a little chizuk, words of encouragement. Feel his broken heart as if it was yours. And the Rambam goes on to expand upon how important it is to bring others to give tzedakah. And then the last part of this Rambam, which I'm not going to go into now, but it's a beautiful, beautiful presentation. The Rambam says that there are 8 different levels of giving tzedakah. And it goes from the top level all the way down to the bottom level. And even if you reach the bottom barrel level, it still is a mitzvah of tzedakah. So again, if we had more time, we would go through all of that.
Do we keep the difference between Maaser and Tzedakah?
Okay, what is Maaser? I was going to leave that for a little bit later, but since Jackie raised the question, let's just go straight for the Gerek, as we say. Okay. Chazal gave us guidelines as to how much money we should separate and earmark for Tzedakah. The answer to how much you should give for tzedakah is very, very complicated. There's no one single answer for everyone. A lot of it has to do with the second part of tzedakah, which is not how much you have to give, but how much they have to receive, meaning it depends a lot on the recipients.
Apologies.
No apologies necessary.
No, we don't have to apologize.
Okay. Here's the way it works. As a general rule, how much do I spend for a single mitzvah out of my entire income, whatever I have?
20%.
Up to 20%. That's a takanas usha. We do not go beyond 20%. The ideal in tzedakah is just that, to give 20%. the name Maisa, which means one-tenth, is really a fallback position. That's not the ideal way of doing it. One should take his income, divide into five-fifths, and one-fifth should be earmarked for tzedakah. And that applies on an annual basis. If he's not able to do that, he feels that that's too much for him, then the next best thing is to give 10%, which is called maaser. Now, if he finds it very difficult to give maaser, then the Chafetz Chaim has an eitzah for him. What's the Chafetz Chaim's eitzah? In his famous work called Avas HaChesed, Chafetz Chaim says he should take 10% of his income, of his net value, and he should dedicate it as a gemach, a free loan society. Which means the money is still his, and any poor person that takes it will return it to him. So it's much easier to give a gemach. But at the same time, since he's using 10% of his funds to help the aniyim, that is a fallback position and a kiyum of tzedakah. So you have three levels then. The best level is 20%. The next level fallback is 10%. And if not that, at least 10% for a gemach, for a free loan society. Now, from what monies do I have to separate maaser? Any profits that come into me, new money, we're talking about cash right now, okay? I don't mean cash in the sense that you actually have the, you know, the picture of whoever the president on it, or the queen, right? But what I mean is, it could have gone from anywhere into your bank account. Once you have possession of those liquid assets, you're obligated in maaser. However, since maaser is something that the people of Israel have taken upon themselves, the Torah never actually delineates specifically a mandate to give 10%. Therefore, the best idea is that when you separate 10%, you should say, B'li neder. I am not committed henceforth to this very strong minog. It's a very powerful custom in Israel, but I'm not personally committed. Once a person becomes committed, then if he chas v'shalom falls back on any occasion, on any year coming up, then he has violated a neder, because when you do something three times and it's a mitzvah, it becomes automatically a neder. So he has to go out of his way to declare b'li neder. So what I'm asking everyone in the room, just as an experiment, okay, maybe I'm treating you like children, but I'm part of the experiment, so I'm treating myself as a child. I want everyone to repeat after me. I will give maaser k'safim, everyone. I will give maaser k'safim b'li neder. And it's very important to add those words, b'li neder, because otherwise you accept upon yourself a neder. Chazal say that if you are meticulous, and what I mean by meticulous, to actually calculate to the grush, you know, there's exactly how much is 10%, then you'll be zocher, you'll merit unbelievable benefits, and God will bestow upon you great things. If you take it laid back, and you know it's about 10%, okay, then I don't know if you'll get those blessings. You'll get whatever you get, but not those blessings. Now let's go on to another question. I spend a lot of my income to feed my family. From what figure do I subtract 10%? Is it from my total income? You know, I make $100,000 a year, so I have to earmark $10,000 for tzedakah, for maaser. Or do I have right to say, well, out of that $100,000, I need $10,000 for food, I need $10,000 for clothing, I need $10,000 for the flat, you know, to pay for, what is it called, the schar dira, you know, rental fees, to have a roof over my head. If I own my own place, I have to pay $10,000 for arnona, and that's probably not that much, I'm not over-exaggerating. And then I add up all these different expenditures, I subtract them from my income, and now I'm left with a profit. On that profit, I have to give 10%.
Are you on that?
Excuse me?
So it's after all your expenses?
So this is the great controversy about Mas. And there's no way anyone could come forward and say, I have a definite answer on this question, because There are two opinions. One opinion is going to tell you have to give masar on every penny that goes into your account. And another opinion will say you only have to take masar out of the profits in your income above and beyond your needs. However, here's the catch 22. Even if we go, which I accept the second opinion, if you're asking me my humble opinion, what are your needs? A man goes away to Garda for Pesach, okay? And he spends $15,000, if you can get it that cheap, for Pesach. Is that called a need? No. A need is determined by the basic society in which he lives, the basic needs of a society in which he lives. This is a sugya masechta ksuvos, which determines how much support a husband has to offer for his wife. And it's a complicated calculation, but the bottom line is you're not spending $1,000 on an expensive suit. You know, in America there's a place called Rodeo Drive, you know, in LA. You know, you're not going to buy a pair of shoes for $2,000, which you can on Rodeo Drive. You're going to buy the average pair of shoes, let's say it costs $100, whatever it costs. A suit costs $300, whatever it is. This, and your wife has needs as well. So what are you calculating here? Three elements: food, clothing, and shelter. At a basic average level, for yourself, your wife, and your children. Now, here's where the poskim have a very complicated issue. What about my grandchildren? Now, basically, we have a principle. This is a sugya masechta Yevamos called Bnei Banim Harehem Kibanim, which means that we treat our grandchildren the way we treat our children. And if our children don't have the wherewithal to support their children, so to the same extent that I have to support my children, I have to support my grandchildren. Okay. However, as everything in life is complicated, halacha is also complicated. And tzedakah is more complicated than most areas in halacha. Because when I subtract my expenditures on the average level, you know, according to the average standard in that particular society, I cannot subtract monies that I'm required to give under a burden, under responsibility of a different mitzvah. I'll give you an example. Let's say I have an obligation to spend $100 on a lulav and an esri, you know, for a dollar meaning. I don't know if $100 is more or less accurate. I don't know. I can't say I'm going to dip into my maaser ksafim, my 10% that's earmarked for tzedakah, in order to buy the dollar meaning. Those monies that I have to spend on the dollar meaning come under a different mitzvah, a different obligation. And that obligation is self-generated by the mitzvah itself. It cannot be used for tzedakah. So now I have to support my children. But do I have to support my children? And here we find something very interesting. There's one answer to that question in the Gemara at the time of Chazal, and there's another answer in the contemporary poskim. In the time of Chazal, and it's hard for us to imagine this because we're not in that sociology, but young children were capable of taking on jobs at a very young age. And I'm only obligated as a parent to support my children up to the ripe old age of 6 years old. Shocking. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, in his Igros Moshe, says that today, in our time, it's up to the age of 16. Which means that your average 16-year-old could go out there and eke out a living for himself. You want to support him beyond the age of 16? That's already tzedakah. That doesn't fill. That doesn't come under any other obligation. I would suggest that in our time, because Rav Moshe wrote this tshuva a good number of decades ago, it would be approximately the age of 18. Which means that after the age of 18, any monies that I'm giving are optional monies and they come under tzedakah. So if my son who's 18 years old wants to go to university or he wants to go to Yeshiva Gedola and he can't pay tuition because he doesn't earn a living, if I dig into my pocket to pay for his education, that money can be taken from Meiser. However, if he's if he's, let's say, 16 years old, or if he's 10 years old, how much more so, those monies are obligatory monies under another category. It's like if I have a firstborn son who's Peter Rechem Le'imo, and I have to give the Kohen 5 Slovim, I can't take the 5 Slovim from my Tzedakah money, because that's a separate, independent Chova. And this is a very important principle, because whenever you talk about Tzedakah, you want to expand, you know, and say, well, everything I do is Tzedakah. I do all these great mitzvahs, and I spend money on them. No, if you're doing a mitzvah and you're spending money on it, that's not Tzedakah by definition, because there's another obligation that generates that monies. Now, I get an aliyah on Shabbos, and I give a Misha Berach. Is that Tzedakah money?
Without the Misha Berach, yes.
So here, Jackie, the poskim say that on the one hand, if I want to get the blessing for supporting the poor people, that I won't get. But on the other hand, I can use ksavim from Meiser for the Misha Berach. Why? Because technically, I can sit down after my aliyah, and I don't have to give a Misha Berach. I don't have to give that money. So technically, since there's no independent obligation that I have to pay that 100 shekel or 500 shekel, whatever I give for the Misha Berach, that's already stuck on. So you're getting the flow of it. You know, the nitty-gritty details have to be worked out. Now, I have here a question that was asked me from Brian, so I'm going to just address this question because I think it's relevant right now. He wants to know about monies that I pay for Mas Hachnasa and Bituach Lumi. So here's what I would say about those monies. Those are definitely basic expenses that can be deducted from the profits from which I have to give maaser. Do you follow what I'm saying? So from my income is 100, I have to shave off 10 for misim, for taxes of different sorts, for bituach lumi, and therefore I will start my calculation of maaser on 90, because I'm taking out after 10. I only have to give 9 instead of 10. But I cannot use the tzedakah money. Let's say I take 9 out of the 90 and use that money to pay the government. Because paying the government is not tzedakah. Now, the Zionists will say, well, wait a minute, the money is going to support the poor and so forth and so on. But basically, it's not a communal charity organization. A community charity organization,
some people it is,
which is earmarked and dedicated exclusively to support the poor people, that could be considered tzedakah. Especially in the state of Israel, it's going primarily to support Jews, which I'm not sure that's true, but let's assume it is. The second question he asked me is about gifts. So here it depends. Do I have to give my son gifts? And this is very relevant to new couples who just got married. The answer is as follows. If they're cash gifts, or what we call gift certificates, that have a clear-cut monetary value because I can transfer it to someone else at X, and it's very clear, then I have to give Maaser on that. I'll get back to that in just a second. If on the other hand it's a physical gift, like I remember my daughter from her wedding, bless them all, 15 people gave her knives, you know, the challah board's knives and all that stuff. Great. I mean, so that you don't, now, that too is a machlokas haposkim, but again, if you ask me my humble opinion, I would tell you there's no need to calculate from Maaser ksav. Now, the gifts that come into this young couple, and blessed are those who give cash gifts, in my humble opinion. Again, I'm not saying every member of my family agrees with me on that, but I remember at our wedding, when my wife and I got married, the best gifts we got from the Italians. I don't mean Jewish Italians. Of course, Italians in America only give cash. They don't want to mess around with checks or anything like that. So, you know, if Joe DiMaggio, you know, gives me a cash gift, I have to give my son that. But here becomes a little bit interesting. Why? Because many couples, they need that money to get started. And with a kal v'chomer, much more so if it's a kollel couple, that they're going to need that money to put food on the table. And it's all part of the calculation that the wedding gifts will help them get off. That, I would say, would come under the expenses from which you don't have to give maaser. So again, if the couple is well founded financially and they get cash gifts, they have to give Maaser on the cash gifts. If, however, they need that money that they're getting as wedding gifts, you know, in Yiddish there's a phrase for this. I learned this from my in-laws. It's called a drasha geschenk. And that's a wedding gift. And the reason why in Yiddish there's a special term for this is because apparently there's some mystical source that says if you don't give a gift to the couple, you may have to come back another time with a gilgul neshama on a different, you know, to pay up those gifts. So, you know, I always tell my wife we have to be very careful to give gifts to couples. And sometimes it's so easy if you don't have it, you know, at the wedding, you know, to forget about it. And then David asked me an interesting question, and he said, in America they have something called a 401k, so what it means your employer will skim off a certain percentage of your salary and put it into a special retirement, what word can I use, a fund, excellent, the word fund. And what happens is that over the course of the years that you work, it accrues a great deal of interest. And it gives you security so that when you retire, you don't have to rely on Uncle Sam, that's the word in America for Bituach Lumi, and Social Security in America is basic, I mean really basic. So you have this 401k plan. So I said to David, here's the answer. If no miser was taken from that money, let's say he put 10 into the account that was skimmed off from his salaries, and it accrued another 10 interest. So now, when he begins to collect this after retirement age, he's going to have to give 10% on both $10,000. The original $10,000 which he earned in salary, plus the 10 that is the dividends, the profits that it made. If, on the other hand, he initially, when he made that salary back in whatever year, he calculated that in his Maaser Ksavim, meaning he calculated his income and he included that money because legally he had rights to that money. He sort of gives up those rights and allows his employer to put it into a fund, but he's the owner of that fund. And tell me if I'm mistaken, I think he can legally, again, he'll take quite a loss on the profits, but you can actually cash in this fund at any time.
Borrow against or take, yeah.
I think so. If you can, then it's really, that fund is really yours.
Yeah.
Then if all things were done in the ideal way, he would have given Maaser way back in the year that he earned that money, and now he would only have to give Maaser on the dividends on the profits. And then Brian asks me about tax benefits for contributions to charitable funds. I don't see any problem with that. If the government wants to give you a break on your taxes because you're giving charity, that's fine. Okay. So those are, what?
The question is, you get 35% back if you give it to Section 46, right? And my question is a little bit more, to make it a little bit sharper, is do you have to give 10% of that 35%, or do you have to give the full 35%?
But wait a second.
I gave 1,000 shekel check.
Is the government sending you 35% in a check?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't understand. I thought the government was saying to you, normally you'd have to be paying 100 in taxes. We're going to give you a tax break, and instead of paying 100, pay us 65. That's one possibility. The other possibility is to say, you're going to pay up 100, and then we'll send you back a check for 35.
Which one? Takes it off your taxes.
Again, that's what I want to know.
Is
it that you paid the government and then they're giving you a rebate, or you never paid the government to begin with?
It's a rebate.
So you're actually getting a check in the mail.
You give 100 shekels, 35 shekels, doesn't come in the mail, but you'll get it off your taxes, which will pay less taxes.
Again, I think we're sort of running around to catch our tail. If you're paying less taxes, then that money never actually came into your account. Mm-hmm. It's not that they're sending you a check after you pay taxes. You know, you pay taxes, we're going to reward you with a gift of 35%. No, that's not what's happening. They're saying that instead of paying us 100 as tax, we're going to be happy and satisfied with 65. That's a tax break. In that case, you got a gift from the government, you know, but they never actually gave you a gift. They only cut down the amount of money that you have to pay them, so that's not relevant to Maaser at all. But if, on the other hand, they send you a rebate, and they actually inject money into your account, then on that money you'd have to give 10%. So if they would inject $35,000 into your account as a break for all the tzedakah you gave, then you would have to give $3,500 of that as Maisa Ksav. Yeah, David?
This may be a silly question, but is the idea of Maisa is to be given to poor people? So the example you gave before, let's say a family who's pretty affluent with a 20-year-old son going off to university, the boy himself has no money because he doesn't work yet, but the family is affluent, so they use the money for tzedakah for his tuition. It seems like you're not using it for
a okay, poor person. So this again comes back to the average standard. For example, in the United States of America, you can send your child to an Ivy League school or to higher-tier schools like Brandeis and NYU, and you could be billed $50,000 or $60,000 in tuition, and maybe I'm already out of data. That's not the normal standard amount of expense. You know, for education, there's a certain average for the United States of America. I don't know if it's $10,000 a year or whatever it might be. In certain countries, you know, education is virtually free, or you pay a very little amount. In America, you have city colleges and so forth where you pay very little, so that you know you cannot subtract, you know, because you decided to send your son or your son decided to go to a very fancy expensive private school. That's not something that you can subtract. Again, it always comes back to the average mean kind of thing. As I said before, I can buy a suit for $250, I can buy a suit for $3,000, so I'm not going to be able to subtract $3,000, I'm going to be able to subtract $250.
You're going to be honest with yourself.
Everything here is honesty.
There's no objective.
There's no one in this physical universe who's looking over your shoulder. It's up there in Shammai. You know the famous story about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. He was once being driven by a balagol, you know, by a wagon driver, and the wagon driver decided to stop on the side of the road, and there was hay that was cut down by some farmer. And he decided that he would help himself to the hay. So he asked Rabbi Yisrael if he would do him a favor and watch the wagon. If anyone comes to yell and scream, so he'll quickly run back. So after the guy leaves him, Rabbi Yisrael starts yelling, "Mirzet, Mirzet, they see you, they see you." He comes back and no one's around. And this goes on three times. So Rabbi Yisrael said, "What I meant is he sees you up in Shemayim." So when it comes to calculating Meiser and Stoker, you know, he sees you. No one else has to see you. Jeremy?
Two questions.
Yes.
Sorry. So you mentioned before about a Mishabera that can be counted as Sadaka money. But what about when you give money to the shul fees? Is that also the same?
That, I think, would be the same. And I'll tell you why. There's a famous Yushalmi in Masechta Peah. A lot of the laws of Tzedakah are in Masechta Peah. Peah means you give 1/60th for the ani, you know, when you cut your field down. And Yushalmi tells a story about two Amoraim, Rav Acha and Rav Oshia, that were on a trip through the city of Lud. And when they got to Lud, Rav Acha turns to Rav Oshia and he starts boasting, I don't think he was being braggy about it, that his parents or his grandparents, you know, his ancestors had built this synagogue in Lud out of their own, you know, their own hard-earned money. And then the Gemara records that Rav Oshia responded to him that they wasted their money. That money should have been earmarked for Talmud Torah, to help young people study Torah. So 5 or 6 centuries ago, there was a great posik by the name of Ma'arik, and he writes the following. He derives two conclusions from this Gemara, from this Yerushalmi. Conclusion number one, it's a great mitzvah to give to the building of a synagogue. And how does he see that? From the very fact that Rav Acha was boasting about the fact that his parents took their hard-earned money and they built this synagogue, it must be a great mitzvah. The second conclusion he derives is that if you have two opportunities, one is to build a synagogue, and the other is to earmark that funds for an ani, for a poor person, especially if he wants to study Torah, then Torah takes precedence over building a synagogue. Now, it's very fascinating. The poskim today think that contemporary life is a little bit different. And they say that back in the day, a synagogue was absolutely critical. There's no such thing as a community, a Jewish community, without a synagogue. Today, what does it mean to open up a synagogue? You know what it means? There's a synagogue on your left, the synagogue on the right. You know, like they say, when you get to the moon with another two Jews, they'll be fighting, which shul do you go to? I go to the other shul. You know? And so that's not considered a great mitzvah to build a shul. But they add the following caveat. They say that if that shul is dedicated for the study of Torah in such a way that it has a unique contribution, then it comes to a higher level than almost all other tzedakos. It's almost pre-tzedakah. What do I mean by pre-tzedakah? Let's say, for example, Nebuchadnezzar, a Jew, is taking captivity. What mitzvah is that? Pidyon Shvuyim. Pidyon Shvuyim comes way before tzedakah. It's not a mitzvah of tzedakah, but it comes before tzedakah. So, for example, if I have X amount of funds, and you know, the shavui, the person who's in captivity, needs that exact amount to redeem himself, I have to earmark that money for Pidyon Shvuyim, even if it means I won't have a dime left for tzedakah, because Pidyon Shvuyim comes before. Other mitzvahs, for example, let's say a person needs, Rachmana Litzlan, a lung transplant, and he doesn't have insurance, and it's going to cost a bomb of money. That takes precedence over all mitzvahs of tzedakah. That's pikuach nefesh. And the poskim, based on this Ma'arik, when it derived that building a synagogue in a community that doesn't have one, not today, you know, where every 5 inches and then, you know, Yankel Beryl opens up another shingle, you know what I'm saying? There's the Dutch shul, and the Italian shul, and then there's the, you know, the Eki shul, and every single kat, you know, Bnei Kiva, and Aguda, this one got a black yelp, this one got, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a community that is building a synagogue. That mitzvah, like the mitzvah of Pidyon Shvuyim, comes even before tzedakah. But let's assume we're not building a synagogue. Then we want to know what's priority. And here the Ma'arik derives the second conclusion, the fact that Rav Oshia responded to Rav Ach, and he said, they wasted their money on building a shul. That money should have been earmarked for these young people who want to learn Torah. So imagine the case of this is in the poskim, this is a major battle. This is really an unanswered question. In Stocker, there are a lot of unanswered questions. You have two people in front of you, we'll call Reuven and Shimon. They each need $10,000, each for a different purpose. And you, we'll call you Levi, you have $10,000 earmarked for Stocker. Reuven needs the money because he's 14 years old and he's at a crossroads in his life. He can either learn in the yeshiva or he has to support himself at the age of 14, 15, 16, whatever the age is. Shimon needs the $10,000 because he's krak. He's an old, sick, poor person. He's not on the verge of dying. He's got a pair of shoes on his feet. He's wearing a shirt. But you know how many weeks it takes him until he can change that shirt? That's how poor he is. Yeah, he's got food in the fridge. You open up his fridge and you'll see a half eaten roll here and an old gestorben, you know, lemon here, you know, from here, and that's what he has in his fridge. He's not starving. It's not pikuach nefesh. To whom do you give the money? Do you give it to the young person because he wants to study Torah? Do you give it to the sick, old, destitute person because he needs to fix a leak on his roof and he doesn't have the money to fix the, you know, the rains are coming down in Manchester or wherever it is, you know, in the I was 3 days in Manchester in my life and I all I saw was rain, you know, and no football, by the way, all I saw was rain. So who do you give the money to? And emotionally, at least I'm talking on behalf of myself, I would say give it to the poor old person who's sick and can't work. But if you ask me what the final psak is, again, as I told you, there is no final psak on this issue, but if you have to come up with a final psak, it's you give it for the Talmud, for Talmud Torah. That's how powerful Talmud Torah is. And this is all pre-tzedakah. We're not even in the midst of tzedakah. We're in other mitzvahs that are so crucial, like building a synagogue or supporting Torah, that this is already before tzedakah. So let's go back to our originals. Let's assume, if everyone's on board, that we've already figured out how to calculate Maisa. Okay, I'm not saying we've answered all the questions. If you come up with other questions, please raise them. But generally speaking, we have the mechanics. Now, to whom do I give the money? So here we go back to the parsha in Re'eh. And the parsha of Tzokin is in
Re'eh.
Oh, okay, that's getting a blessing from Hashem. But where should I give the money? No, but where? To whom? Do you understand my question? Is everybody clear? Okay. So the pasuk says, achicha. And achicha in Chazal means a relative. Now, I have many relatives. To whom should I give the money? I have many relatives that are in need. So again, first we said, support yourself, your wife, and your children, and maybe even your grandchildren, on a basic level. Okay, that's accurate. You've already done that. Now you still have some money left. Hard to believe, but you still have money left. So what do you do now? So who comes first? A father comes first. After a father or mother, after parents, come your siblings. Again, you've already covered your children. If you haven't covered your children, then we're not even talking about the mitzvah of tzedakah. Forget it. There's nothing to talk about. So you've covered your children. Your wife is considered ishtoku gufo. Your children is banim areim kim bnei banim, bnei banim areim kim banim. Everyone's together here. Now I have a sibling. My sibling needs money. My parents don't need any money, or whatever I needed to give them, I gave them. And now my sibling. So here, this is fascinating. There's a parsha in the Torah, in Parsha's Matos, which tells me exactly how I have to divvy up my money. This parsha is the parsha of Nachla. Who inherits first? So somebody dies, and now we have to determine how to cut up his estate. And it all depends on who's related, so to speak, Karav Yoser. Okay? And it works like this. If we finished up with parents and children, grandchildren, then we're up to siblings, a brother comes before a sister. And now I have two brothers. I have one brother who's a paternal brother, and I have one brother who's a maternal brother. My paternal brother comes first. Because in Dina Yerusha, the Torah says, Ish, it goes by the male. And then we go through the entire system of Yerusha, and we figure out how to divvy up our tzedakah money. Who comes first? That's as far as relatives are concerned. Relatives are number one on the list. I covered all my relatives. My uncles, my siblings, my parents, my siblings, my uncles, my nephews, my nieces. Everyone is tefreden. Everyone's happy. Now someone's not relative. He's a rochok. Who do I give the money to? So here Jackie says very well. Well, you said it. Who said it? Ani eir chakot. Now, what's Aniyei Ircha? First of all, let me ask you, how long do I have to live in a city together with you in order to give me rights that I can now claim I get precedence in Stoker because I'm a member of your city? So that's the Gemara Bava Basra. The Gemara Bava Basra asks, at what point does the city have rights to tax you as a member of the city? And it depends on 30 days. So somebody moved into the city a month ago, he's considered a citizen of that city. But there are many citizens in the city. Who comes first? Your neighbors come first. So imagine, I have someone living in my building, I have someone who lives down the block, or in the next building over, I have to give to the person who lives in my building. One exception to the rule. If my close friend has a need, he depends upon me. And I have to come through in the clutch. If I have the money for a close friend, that takes precedence even over Aniyei Ircha because he depends upon me. I've covered all the idea of my sin, if you can imagine that. Now, somebody comes from another city. Who comes first? It depends if he's Israeli or he lives in Chutzlar. Shabbos. Because the Torah says, B'she'arecha, and Aniye Eretz Yisrael Kodmu li'Aniye Chutz La'aretz. So it comes to light like this. If I've covered all my expenses on a basic level, now I have X amount of profit, I designate 10% of that profit to Li Neder. That money I give first and foremost to my parents if they're in need. Again, I've covered my children, I've covered my grandchildren, my parents. If not my parents, my siblings. If not my siblings, I go to my uncle through my paternal father. If that's covered, I go to my uncle from my maternal father. From my mother, I meant to say. And then I go down to cousins. Okay, so that's how it works. I finish with my family, now I'm dealing with strangers. Again, the Rambam says everybody's part of your family. But I'm dealing with strangers. I need a ircha kodem. You have two people coming, one lives here, the other is panhandling because he came from a different city, you give him the one that lives in your city. If he lives in your neighborhood, you give the one who lives in your neighborhood. If he lives in your building, you give him in your building. The exception is a good friend. Then we have aniyim coming from other cities. And here, you know, whoever comes to ask, and you have the money to give them from your meiser money, you have to give them, unless somebody is from Chutz La'aretz, and that's different. What are the obligations, just to review what we said already, that come before tzedakah? Those are, number one, pikuach nefesh, someone who's dying because he doesn't have money to eat. Someone who's pinyon shvuyim, because that's considered like a pikuach nefesh, you never know what they're going to do. Someone who needs, rachmana litzlan, a lung transplant, and he doesn't have insurance to cover it.
Doesn't matter where they live.
What do you say? It doesn't matter where he lives.
Could be in Japan.
Could be in Japan. And he's not related to you, he's in Japan, but he has a pikuach nefesh situation that comes before everything.
First Jews and then afterwards.
I'm talking about Jews now. You're asking about Goyim, that's a different issue. Now, here's the rub. You're building a synagogue, that comes before tzedakah. That's the Ma'arik. But what about Torah? Where does that fit in? And that's the second chiddush of the Ma'arik that I want to review with you. A guy comes from Japan, as Brian says. Again, I don't know if a Jew coming from Japan is poor. But let's say, are there poor Jews in Japan? Let's assume there may be such a thing.
I need Switzerland, isn't it?
Okay, so there's a poor Jew coming from Japan, and he knocks on my door. He's a Talmud Chacham. Or he wants to use the money to study Torah. That puts him in a very, very hard category. Now I want to ask you the following question. There are two people knocking on my door. One is my father. Is there anyone who might take precedence over my father? No pikuach nefesh. We're not building a synagogue.
Not at all.
Exactly. How do you know such a thing, Jack?
Right.
I'll be very impressed
if you're
ready. How can... I'll be very impressed, Jack, if you could tell me in what masechta I would find a source for that conclusion. You won't believe it. It's in the Masechta Bava Metzia. Here's the case. Your father lost an object, and you found it. Let's say he lost a shepsel, a little sheep. You have to take care of it, feed it, clean it up, and give it back to him whenever the opportunity comes. You already lost something. You found that also. Now you have a priority issue. To whom do you return the Aveda first? And you'll be shocked. You give it to your Rebbe. And the Mishnah codifies it. Why? Again, well, I'll give you all the conditions. I'm just giving you first the abstract halacha. There are many, many conditions that have to be met. But just in abstract terms, why does your Rebbe come first? So the Mishnah says, Avicha heviacha le'olam hazeh, ve'rabcha heviotcha le'olam haba. Fascinating discussion. That someone could come before your own father, the Mitzvah Kibud Avayim, it's up there in the... Well, we don't have it here yet, but one day somebody will donate, if we're talking about building a synagogue, someone will donate the Aseres HaDibros. We don't have one here, I don't think. I never walked into a shul without the Aseres HaDibros. In America, it's unheard of. I assume the same as in other countries.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you speaking of the parochas?
I don't know about the parochas, but in America, on top of the parochas, you have the Aseres HaDibros. In Italy, I assume it's the same. In South Africa, no?
For Dishma.
For sure.
Yeah.
With the cream.
No, I saw a Sephardic shul in Brooklyn, New York. It's unbelievable. The ark itself goes from here till Ad LaShamayim. And it's all the Aseres HaDibros on two sides of the ark. And you close it and you see the Aseres HaDibros. You'd have to be totally blind not to be able to read all the Aseres HaDibros. That's how big it is. In any event, it says Kaveh Savicha. But your Rebbe comes first.
Unless your father teaches you.
Oh, so here are the exceptions. Jackie says number one. What if your father is your Rebbe? Exception number two. What if you have many Rebbeim? I have a Rebbe who taught me in fourth grade, and I have a Rebbe who taught me in 50th grade. You know, who is my Rebbe? So then it comes to Rebbe Muvok. What's a Rebbe Muvok? Very complicated.
Yeah.
Some say Rebbe Muvok is the Rebbe who taught you most of what you know. Does anybody here tell me, can anyone here tell me that there's one single Rebbe who taught him most of what he knows?
Yes.
In Torah? It's almost unheard of. Others say it's the Rebbe that got you on your feet, meaning he gave you what's called a Derech HaLimut. He gave you the approach, how to understand something.
Or put your back onto the right.
Jeremy,
what happens at the lacha if a rebbe and your father come to the door? They both need it, but the rebbe wants it because he wants to use that tzedakah to support somebody else. Is that still the same?
No, I'm talking. So rebbe comes from himself.
Okay, fine. Right. Okay.
Only if he comes from himself.
Your father also comes from himself.
Yeah,
and your father also comes from himself. Now I went into the internet, and I pulled out a very interesting essay here from someone I know personally. His name is Rav Yirmiya Kaganov. Do you know him at all?
Ah, of course.
He's a Gevaldige Talmud Chacham, Kaganov, Rabbi Kaganov.
Must be a Kohen.
I assume he's a Kohen. I don't remember right now. I haven't seen him in many years.
The name usually is a Kohen.
I'll mention this just in passing. Amongst the projects that he took on himself, there was a Sukkot Shavuot Rebbe who wrote a book called the Igle Tal. The same author of the Avni Nezer. And he said for himself, the Igle Tal, Tes Lamed is 39, at the task of defining all 39 malachas. But he died after he finished the ninth malacha. So this Rabbi Kaganov took it upon himself to finish the project. That means to write about 30 different malachas. But anyway, he has an essay here, 7 pages, which I printed out of my printer, called How Do I Distribute My Tzedakah? So I just want to mention a few things that I found here that were very interesting to me. We said that when you calculate Maaser, you're not allowed to subtract expenditures for luxury items, you know, for above and beyond what's considered normal and standard. What if the recipient is asking for money for a luxury item? So what would be your knee-jerk response?
Yes.
Absolutely not. Why do I have to? He needs a luxury. He wants to buy a Ferrari. I mean, what do I care? Let him go fly a kite. What?
He wants to fly business class.
Okay, business class. Or he wants to go to see some game there in Europe or something. You know, I have to dip and support him for that. Fascinating. He says the following. There's a Gemara that establishes, I think it's in Masechta Nedarim, something called Sus Lirkovalov. This man was used to riding a horse.
Yeah.
Today you would call it what are the fancy cars today?
Mercedes.
A Mercedes, yeah, but there's another one in Alpha America became
Lexus.
Lexus.
No, not a Lexus. Okay, anyway, whatever it is. I have a Talmud who knows every single car that was ever on the road. But so he gets used to riding a horse. I have to buy him a horse. If again, if I have the money, if I don't have the money, that's something else. Why? Because Yared Min HaChazmi went down financially. Then he has another chiddush here, which for me was something very, very new. He says that the optimal level of stock of fulfilling this mitzvah is 20%, and he says that he's always has to take this percentage from his cash inventory. And then he asks, what happens if he wants to, I'm just looking for the place here. He wants to give more than 20%.
Up to 30 is okay.
So listen to what he says. I don't know about 30%. Jackie, maybe you have a source for that. I'm just telling you what I see here. That in Staka, if he gives more than he's required to give, 20%, then he can subtract that from next year's Meiser. It's like a rolling kind of obligation, carrying it from one year to the other. And he says that if, let's say, he wants to give a gift, a contribution to a poor person, and the poor person is not willing to accept it. I don't know if you've ever had that experience.
It often happens.
Oh man, in Har Nof, it's, you know, in Har Nof, my wife and I know that if we're going to answer the doorbell from, let's say, I would say about 8 to 10, those 2 hours, we're going to be giving out stucca money for 2 hours straight. I mean, that's the way it works in Har Nof. I don't know if it's true in all neighborhoods. What? I say, for 2 hours straight, you could just be busy with... The bell doesn't stop ringing. And by the way, they ring the bell. You know, I have a sign there. But so he says the following. If the guy is not happy with what you think, in all honesty and fairness, is what you can donate, he says, you're not required to give him more. However, you cannot say that if he gives you back the money, or he refused to accept the money, that you fulfilled the mitzvah of tzedakah. You're just not in violation of the mitzvah of tzedakah. He says, what do you do if you know of someone in the community who desperately needs help, but it would just crush him from embarrassment if you came over to offer him a check? So he says, the first thing you should do is to alert the Gabbai Tzedakah in that neighborhood and to rack your brains to figure out some sort of method of helping this neighbor without jeopardizing his self-dignity. So these are a few things that I found in these 7 pages. Okay. Shach says something absolutely fascinating. I'm afraid to say this, but halach is halach, and I can't rewrite the text. So if you don't like it and you're uncomfortable, go write a letter to the Shach. The Shach writes in Siman Reish Mem Zion, based on a Gemara that tells the story about Rabbi Yossi, that he supported his wife even after they were divorced. He says that afilu li'achar gerushin yesh inyan lahamid es ishto hagrushaso kikrova, that you should consider your ex-wife as high priority on your list of tzedakah because she is still considered in some sense your relative. That blew my mind completely.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's different if this would be considered tzedakah or miser, or if you can detract of her income.
He's saying like this, that this is tzedakah. If she needs this money, you know, to support herself, that's tzedakah. So you designated $10,000 out of your $100,000 income for tzedakah. That $10,000 could go to your ex-wife. Again, the ideal way of doing it is always to divide it up. You know, you don't give all, you know, you, as we say, you don't put all your eggs in one basket. Okay. What about a person who comes to knock on your door and you happen to know that he wastes away his money?
On Purim, you give nevertheless.
Okay, so next week, if you're interested, I'd like to talk about Purim. Because I have a whole share of Matnas Aniyim to see how it's different on Purim. But in terms of Hilchus Tzedakah, Rav Moshe says that Meikar Adin, if the guy doesn't have money, you still have a mitzvah of tzedakah. However, other poskim say that if it gets out of hand to the point to which he's taking loans and he's not returning that money, then you're really not chayv in the mitzvah of tzedakah.
If he spends for drink,
right,
to buy drugs.
Gambling.
Okay.
The gambling is different.
Here's another interesting question that I found in the poskim. There's a sefer called The Laws of Tzedakah and Meiser from Rav Shimon Tal. And he wants to know the following. What if a person wants to get married? And he knows that he doesn't have the money to establish his household. Is he allowed to collect tzedakah based on the fact that he wants to get married? And he quotes many poskim that say yes. And he flips it around the other way. He says, well, if you're allowed to take tzedakah based on future needs, because you're about to get married, then you're allowed to withhold tzedakah if you have future needs. And that's what I discussed with you, I touched with you before. You have a couple that just got married, and they know that they need the money, maybe not today, but over the course of the few months or the year coming up. Are they obligated in the mitzvah of tzedakah? And the answer is, according to this, no.
I heard once that you have to build a nadin for your daughters. You can deduct the money, but only one third. Two thirds have to go
to other tzedakahs.
To other tzedakahs. And one third you can put
right.
aside.
Right. You know, we didn't even talk tonight about the mitzvah of Hachnasas Kala. Again, that's a whole nother discussion. Okay. Last but not least, you have two aniyim that are coming to collect. They're both krovim, or they're both from the same city, they're both from another city. No one has any priority. However, one of them needs food. The other needs clothing. So the halacha is that mizonos, food, comes first. And the Gaon has a chiddush here, the Vilna Gaon. He writes that not only if these two aniyim are equal, but even if one comes from a far off city, but he needs money for mizonos, and the local ani needs money for beged, for clothing, you give to the far off. In other words, according to Vilna Gaon, you only apply the principle of Aniye Ircha Kodman if all else is equal. But if, on the other hand, he needs it, even though he's coming from another far off city for food, and how much more so if he needs it for, you know, for a surgery and he doesn't have coverage, he comes first. But what happens if you have two people coming for tzedakah? One is asking for begadim, the other is asking for food. However, the one who's asking for begadim is a Talmud Chacham, and this was help him in his Torah study. The one who's asking for, I meant to say for clothing, what did I say? Yeah. The one who's asking for food is a regular citizen, he doesn't need money for Torah, he's just trying to eke out a living, but he needs money for food. So the Ramah Paskins in Reish Nun Aleph, Siftes, that you give to the Amoritz, even if he's a regular guy, he's not a scholar, but he needs it for food, that's how far the din of Ochel in priorities go, and therefore you give him. One last point, and then I let you go. The Rambam in the 8th parak of Hilchos Matnas Aniyim establishes, based on the sugya at the end of Horios, that let's say all things are equal. No one who's requesting money has any priority over the other one. Then we go back to the mitzvah of pidyon shvuyim. And the Mishnah at the end of Horios establishes what is the priority system for pidyon shvuyim when more than one Jew was taken captive. And this is fascinating. A Kohen comes before a Levi. A Levi comes before a Yisrael. In other words, the laws of Yuchsin determine Kedima. Now what's fascinating here is that a Levi deserves to get Kedima because he serves in the Beis HaMikdash. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash. And the poskim say that Afilu Bizman Hazeh, despite the absence of the Avodah of the Beis HaMikdash, he has an inherent status as a Levi, and therefore he comes first. Then the poskim write that if somebody did you a great favor, he gets priority in stock. There's a mitzvah of gratitude in stock, akarat hatov. However, and here's very fascinating, you have two people coming to you for stock. One is your enemy. He's a sone. The other is someone who did you a favor. Who should you give first? You give the sone first. Unbelievable. This is a different parasha in the Torah. You see how all the Torah overlaps. Prika uteina. The Torah says, If you have two people to help, to take the burden off or put it on, you help the sone first. Why? Because then you want to overcome that natural sense of kemayim panim apanim, that he hates me, I'm going to hate him. And the Mishnah goes on to say in Horios that a melech, a king, comes before a kohen gadol, and there are many different categories of a kohen gadol. There's a kohen gadol who serves in the Beis HaMikdash. There's a kohen gadol who's a mashuach mulchama. There's a kohen gadol who used to be a kohen gadol and now he's already retired as a kohen gadol. And then there's somebody called the Skan Kohen Gadol. Then there's a Navi. In a word, there's a very detailed priority list. And the one who does the most research on this, if you're ever interested in seeing it, is Rav Chaim Kanevsky. He wrote a book called Derech Emuna. And one volume of this 6 or 7 volume series is dedicated to the laws of Tzedakah. It's about this thick. So if you ever have nothing to do with yourself, get yourself a copy of the Derech Emuna of the Grach Kanevsky, and you'll enjoy it. I promise you, you'll have fun. Tzedakah is, on the one hand, as we said at the outset in the name of the Rambam, the greatest of all mitzvahs, but on the other hand, the most complicated of all mitzvahs. I tried to make it as simple as I could, and I hope you came with, I hope you're leaving here with more information and a clearer picture than when you came in.
It's still subjective.
But it's still very, very difficult to exactly find the balance, but at least we have the guidelines now. We have the priority systems. And I want to wish everyone well, and thanks to Brian for organizing this year. We should all be zocher that we should be mekayim in the midst of tzedakah, and then tzion b'mishpat yipadeh v'shaveh b'tzedakah v'zocher to Mashiach and to the Gula Shleima b'mehir v'yameinu.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you so much.
Is it written down anywhere in the government post, like the standard, what an average family should be spend for food, clothing, shelter?
Yeah, you can get it online. You know, I don't know exactly how you punch it in, but...
It might cost more Jerusalem than it might cost somewhere else for...
Correct. I think there are published figures on this question. You know, it's not secretive.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, thanks.